I was raped in Milan, Italy, just 7 weeks before the Miss World contest. When my name was announced as the winner, I began to understand my mission and that it had chosen me. Every time I hear someone's story, it takes me back to my own.
I want to shout out that rape can happen to anyone.
I was raped when I was 17 years old.
A man broke into my house, stabbed me, and raped me.
My mom, I'm afraid that she'll look at me and be disappointed.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, former New York City prosecutor and retired FBI profiler and writer-producer for CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today in the studio is
Laura Richards, advocate, author, and director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes and the minds that make documentaries about those crimes.
Well, today, in that vein, we have a very special guest.
I'm Cecilia Peck. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I'm the director and producer of Brave Miss World.
Well, thank you so much for coming today, Cecilia. We're really happy to have you.
Thanks so much for having me.
I mean, congratulations on the documentary, because I remember coming to the screening with Jim when I first came to LA, and it just absolutely blew me away.
Me too.
It's an incredible piece of work.
Well, thanks. It was an indie documentary that has reached a lot of people, and we got nominated for an Emmy, so it was really exciting to see it go from just an idea to go that far. And now we have a huge website, then we have 5 million visitors. We do outreach to rape survivors all over the world.
So what's the website?
It's bravemissworld.com.
And I've been on it a number of times, and I know there's so much on there, so maybe we should take some time and talk a little bit about the site and about what you're doing with the site.
Well, the site grew out of the film. When Lenore Abargil, who's the subject of the film, decided to tell her story, she launched a website in Israel. And at the beginning, it had, 14 visitors and then 300, and now it has 5 million. But it was the way she decided to share her story. And through the website, she started meeting with the survivors who posted their testimonials. And we filmed her traveling around the world meeting with other survivors of rape and assault.
That's great. And so for listeners who don't know, Lenore was a Miss World contestant. And 6 weeks before she actually won the title of Miss World, she was raped by a guy who was supposed to be her protector. And she nevertheless sort of pulled herself together and didn't say anything to anybody, and yet went on with the competition, and it wasn't until much later that she actually spoke out about it.
Well, in the film, we have the footage of her being crowned, and you see this expression of terror and trauma and tears on her face, and they weren't the regular tears of being excited and emotional. It was because, as you said, only 7 weeks before, she had been through the worst experience of her life, a very brutal and violent abduction and stabbing and rape crime in Milan. And only she and her family knew about it. And she went to the competition in trauma, but she had to represent her country, Israel. And also her mother thought it might help her recover and get her mind off this rape, but never expecting that she would win. And she also said, Israel never wins. Really thought she'd go home shortly, and they kept calling her name as it got narrowed down. And then the moment they announced Miss Israel as the winner, she made a kind of vow to herself. She felt that there must be a reason that the worst and best things in her life had happened in such close proximity. So she decided that she would one day tell her story and reach out to other survivors. But it took her 10 years to get ready.
I think that was such a powerful part, just seeing her being crowned. And then you hear somebody say, and she has tears of joy. And I'm looking at her face, trained as a facial profiler, incidentally, and I'm seeing absolute pain, fear, so many things coming to the surface, all in micro expressions, but they certainly weren't tears of joy. And you can almost see that actually in her, that the realization that she could do and use this as a force for good in those moments of her world sort of falling apart, but also, this incredible thing that has happened to her. And I think, it, you know, it's amazing testament to her that 6 weeks before she's raped. And the bit that really stood out to me too was what she said about her mother, that in that trauma and in that violence where she was stabbed, this was a very brutal rape, that she called her mother just not knowing what to do, and she survived something that maybe could have ended a very different way.
Absolutely.
And her mother saying to her, you know, you must go to the police. And that's exactly what she did. And she owes a lot to her mother, she says in her own voice, because of her mother's reaction, never blaming her, never shaming her, never making her feel guilty. And she goes to the police and they take all of the forensic evidence. And I think that's a very important part to this story.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that made me want to take it on and decide to go on the journey with her, is because of the mother and daughter relationship. And I think the film, in a way, is a guidebook to how anyone who surrounds, who loves, is, who cares for a victim of assault, it really teaches you how to respond, and that the only appropriate response is, I believe you, I trust you, I'm going to help you. And not, what were you doing in that car? Or,
right.
What were you wearing? Or were you drinking?
I was so moved by that. I mean, each time I watch it, even on the trailer, it moves me to tears because of when her mother speaks about it, you know, and just how painful it is for Lenore, for somebody who's survived something so traumatic. And then the first people they tell is so important, like you said, and her mum's reaction, you see her father's reaction and people around them. You know, it's the difference between somebody going forward and talking to the police, or somebody keeping the secret, you know, some for their whole life course, and feeling that they were somehow to blame for it.
Right. And let me just say, you don't always, you know, some victims aren't able to go to the police because that's traumatic. But Lenore's point and the message of the film is that you must talk to someone. You must find someone you trust and not keep it inside.
Mm-hmm. Well, why don't we start? Why don't we go back a little bit? And why don't you tell us about how you came to this project, how you decided to do it, how you met Lenore, and let us know how that progressed.
Well, it's so important to remember that when this happened to Lenore, she was only just 18, and it was a time before there was conversation about rape. It was still a very taboo subject. So
this is 1998?
98, yes, when she was raped and crowned. And she spent those 10 years healing herself and getting ready to speak out. And when she felt strong enough, she and her best friend, the producer of the film, Moti Reif, came to Los Angeles to look for a team of women filmmakers to follow her on her journey. And at that time, another film I had done called Shut Up and Sing was playing theatrically, and Lenore saw it, and she felt that she wanted her film to take the audience on the same kind of journey as that film. And she asked to meet me, and through friends in common, the director Hugh Hudson and producer Howard Rosenman, they found me. And we sat down in a cafe here in West Hollywood with Lenore and Moti, and I brought Inbal Lesner, who was the editor and became also a producer on the film. So it was that conversation, and really the way Lenore talked about her experience with no shame. You know, she was so frank about it. And I'd never heard anyone talk about being raped without being so embarrassed and so shy. So that made a really strong impression on me. And I thought that was powerful. And, you know, I said that to her. I said, I'm so impressed with how openly you can talk about this. And she almost snapped at me. She said, why should I be ashamed? The fault was his, not mine. So I remember a light bulb going off then and thinking, she's so powerful. She's so riveting. She's clearly still broken in some ways. But if she can deliver that message to an audience and take us on her journey of healing and recovery, that could be really interesting. And then also, you know, her speaking about her mother.
That's so powerful. You know, her saying the shame resides with the perpetrator and not with me.
Mm-hmm.
Switching that script.
But it was a journey to get there, right? Because certainly in the beginning, she didn't feel that way. And it's unfortunate, but most victims take on the blame for being victimized, for being in that situation and so forth. And that would be one of the themes that you discuss in the documentary.
Well, you know, he was a serial predator. He'd been charged with rape crimes in three different countries that are known about, possibly more. And he had managed to convince juries in all of those countries that he was innocent. So she was the one who had the strength and the courage to press charges. And I'd love to talk about how she got the jurisdiction transferred from Italy to Israel and everything it took for her to convict him. But she did, and then wow. She made a statement once the guilty verdict was delivered to all the women in Israel. She said, if this happened to you, don't be afraid. If I could get through this, you can too. Don't be afraid to report. And that made a huge impact in her country. The incidence of reports almost doubled in the following year.
That's amazing.
And later, there were laws changed as a result of her case, including before Lenore, a victim of rape did not have access to anyone in the prison system to find out whether the rapist was on furlough, had been released. There was no information. So that law was enacted because of her, which wow. sounds like it should be obvious.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But it wasn't. So she accomplished a lot in her country. But the point was, even though at the time of the rape, I think even someone as strong as Lenore, you even if you're held down, tied up, gagged, abducted, you still think, why did this happen? Is it my fault? But Lenore, I think, was pretty unusual in that at the same time, she also felt, I'm never going to lose again.
Right.
I'm going to take control of my life from now on. And I think she says that's why she won the crown, too, because the judges saw something in her.
Determination.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So should we talk about actually what happened?
So Lenore had gone to a modeling audition with her boyfriend, who was a model, and they ended up telling him to go to business school and giving her a modeling contract. That's how she started modeling. And her agency immediately enrolled her in the Miss Israel pageant, and it was the farthest thing from her thoughts, but she was crowned Miss Israel that year. So all of a sudden, this young girl from Netanya was Miss Israel, and then the Miss World competition was coming up, and she was sent to Milan to model in between becoming Miss Israel and competing in Miss World. So she arrived in Milan alone, and she was sent out on the go-sees. She wasn't enjoying it. She didn't like going to those modeling auditions. She didn't feel comfortable in the model's apartment they had put her in, so she started trying to get home almost right away. And she needed to rebook her ticket, and the modeling agency connected her with a travel agent who spoke Hebrew to help her. And the modeling agency told her there were no flights from Milan and that he could drive her to Rome because he had found a flight for her from there. So she got in his car, and It was nighttime.
Had she ever met him before? Did she?
She had spoken to him all week in the context of trying to get a ticket home, and by that time she felt she trusted him because he spoke her language. She didn't speak Italian.
Sure, and he was set up. Yeah, she was set up by the agency.
Right, her modeling agency vouched for him and said this guy will help you.
Had she ever traveled before? Is this her first time out? Because she's 18, isn't she? So she's relatively...
She's 18. I think she had been out of the country once on a modeling assignment to Germany.
So trust is a key thing here, you know, that you're in the hands of other people. So she trusts the fact that this is a legitimate person who's going to help her and she'll be safe.
Absolutely. And he picked her up to take her to the airport. He stopped at his apartment, which she thought was strange, but she didn't think anything of it. He said he had to take a shower. She wasn't terribly comfortable there, but she sat and waited. They got in the car, and then all of a sudden, in a deserted area, he pulled the car over. He told her to take off her clothes. She started fighting him and screaming. He tied her up very quickly. He had a knife. He started to prick her with it around her chest whenever she spoke. He raped her. He put a plastic bag over her head and used the rope to tighten the bag. She thought her life was over. He raped her again. It was a brutal, traumatic 3 hours.
Ugh.
And in the middle of it, at one point, she felt that he might be coming back to himself. And so she started to talk to him, and she asked him about her. He was married. She asked about his wife and children and started bringing him back down. And at which point he said, I can't believe I did this again. And she said so brilliantly, don't worry. I would never tell anyone. let's just call this a one-night stand, and I really hope I can see you again. Would you just take me to the train station? And so her lawyer said later that that saved her life, mm-hmm. probably.
I'm sure that it did.
Yeah, well, that's very that's very intuitive on her part. That's her survival skills kicking in. We've covered a number of cases, like when we did the show Killer Profile, a number of cases in which people have unfortunately fallen into the hands of very vicious, sadistic serial killers. But in each of those cases that we covered, somebody did survive because they were able to instinctually kick in their life-saving, life force, life instinct, and it really helped them think in the moment and come up with a way to manipulate the offender away from killing them.
And I should also say that she was sodomized, which I think, and you tell me, is something that rapists do to make it even harder for victims to report. Would you all agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's another way to demean and hurt a victim. And, of course, I don't want to give away too much, but, I mean, when I talk to Lenore, I know that she was still harboring this guilt about having put herself in that situation, having allowed herself to be manipulated like that. And this is just, and I will say this, that when we did cover cases like this in the behavioral analysis unit, that one of the very important aspects was all the details of what happened, because when you're profiling a case like this, the behavior is incredibly important. And any control that the offender has is going to be exacerbated when the victim feels shamed and demeaned and less of a person. And certainly that would add to it.
Well, also, I think that she did not report that aspect in Italy, but later when her case was tried in Israel, she did, and the rapist lawyers used that against her, saying she had changed her story, so she must be lying. But Jim, also, you know, I want to say that when she talked to you, I think was the first time she understood that she had been groomed by him. She didn't have a context for that concept. Mm-hmm. She didn't realize that each day that she was trying to get home, she became more and more dependent on him. And I think that was a really important step in her education and healing.
All right, well, we'll talk about how I got involved in the project, how Lenore interviewed me. But first, we should finish the story about what happened to Lenore and how she got back home.
I believe the mother and father needs to know. Not to ask nothing, just say, I believe you and I'm here for you. That's it. Because if you say one thing like, why did you go there? I told you so. What? No. I mean, anything you'll say will sound like you blame your child. And this child will never speak to you again.
So Laura, you had a question for...
So I was just going to pick back up on the question that you asked, actually, about, you know, the sodomy aspect of this rape, and certainly, you know, entwined with the grooming, because, you know, I strongly believe, having profiled and analysed thousands of cases, there's a number of things that go on. And with this particular case, given that he's a serial rapist, he's been predatory to many women, I believe that the fact that he took her to his home address... firstly, when he's showering, etc., he's probably testing compliance at that point, just to see whether she's somebody who's going to be compliant or non-compliant.
Good point.
And putting her in his home address, you know, kind of makes it look like it's a much more friendly sort of exchange. But he's trying to see her reaction to things. And we have to bear in mind she's 18. I mean, she's really young. And, you know, this contract that she's got, and she's out of her own country, which always makes, we talked about it with Meredith Kircher, always makes you feel much more vulnerable when you haven't got your peer support around you. She's just desperate to get home. So she's being subservient and acquiescing in many senses. She's got no reason not to trust him. But her instinct's telling her this is off. There's something that's not quite right here. But it's not enough to really do anything or say anything.
Right, because she was also so grateful she had his help.
She wants
to keep overtly threatening her at this point.
Right, they're talking in the same language. There's lots of positive things that's going on. But our innate instincts telling us, you know, in these points that something's off. But she probably felt not enough to really say anything. She just wants to get in the car, get to Rome, get her flight home and be with her family again.
Mm-hmm.
So when he manages to get her in the car and he's talking to her, and I remember her talking about that journey, it's sort of the opening sequence to the documentary, her revisiting that journey, which is just so moving, and her talking through what happened, and you can see her going back into that time, back into that place. You know, he keeps her for 3 hours at knife point. He's punched her in the face multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
She is in fear for her life. He feels he has 100% compliance, and it's probably likely he feels that, you know, it's part of his rape script, part of his fantasy of power and control, that he dominates her in every way. So the vaginal rape, the sodomy is part of that. But the shame and the fear and everything that, you know, you see her relive, it's just so real. And probably those things compounded have meant that there are lots of victims who have never spoken out, who have suffered at his hands, and he's probably learnt that through his own experience, and therefore that whole rape script and fantasy script, he acts out everything because he has ultimate control and seclusion and isolation to do so.
And I have to say that return to Italy was the most difficult and challenging shoot of the film. She hadn't been back there in 10 years. She'd been much too afraid to step foot in Italy, but she felt that she had to. You know, she wanted to. She was ready to, and she thought she had to confront it in order to heal. And she had been trying to become pregnant with her new husband, and they hadn't been able to. And interestingly, after that trip, she was able to. I don't know if there was a connection, but I think it was a really important step for her to take.
Mm. Sounds like a very important journey, but for you to capture it, you know, it's just so moving. And, you know, the fact that he, you know, it's for such a brutal experience that she turns it round into such a positive thing. But you can see, you know, for 10 years, going back to that country, it doesn't matter the passage of time, you are reliving it with her. You're hearing her fears. And when I train law enforcement, I don't know about you, Jim, but I always have to put a caveat. When you have a survivor, you have to remind law enforcement that that person at that time did not know whether they were going to live or die.
Mm.
You know, they have no idea about the outcome. They are, as Jim said, putting in every coping mechanism, compliance normally, because they understand if they're quiet, then they may get through it. But the fact that she understands and intuits that she needs to kind of ground him back into who he is and bring a sense of reality back to him saved her life. And to law enforcement, I always have to say, you have to remember that why somebody has said that is because they're using every tactic they can to survive. But of course, when you're reading a rape statement, it's clear, and you've got the person before you, that they did survive. So I have had people say, well, she said it was a date, or she said, you know, and played out that it was a relationship or there was some intimacy. That's a real problem, Laura. That's going to be a problem at court. And I always have to put that very clearly out there, that somebody does not know if they're going to live or die, and they are using every survival tactic to get through that experience. I don't know about you, Jim, whether you've seen that as well.
Absolutely, and it's unfortunate. And there, some of the stories that are on your website, bravemissworld.com, are stories of women who suffered brutal rapes or were drugged and were raped and don't even know what happened to them, and yet the prosecutors are and the police are just not educated enough about the fact that survival is the number one goal. And yes, you have to say and sometimes do things to survive, but that shouldn't undermine the case.
Mm-hmm.
The case should be about this person being victimized by an offender, period. It shouldn't be about specific words that are said and specific actions that are taken. And the fact is that because, you know, the offenders are sophisticated, especially repeat offenders, they learn, their MO improves over time, and they use vulnerabilities and they use chinks in the law and loopholes in order to get away with doing it over and over and over again.
And try and discredit the victim in the process. They know the things that are coming because they've been in the system, and when they're serial and when they're predatory, they've learned through experience. And here is a sadly classic example. You know, three countries, there could well be more,
mm-hmm.
and many, many victims.
But I want to go back and tell you what happened after, you know, she talked him down out of that rage and the rape. But I also wanted to touch on one thing you said about going back to Italy being a trigger. and all the things that can trigger survivors and bring the experience back. And when we were scoring the film, the great composer Hans Zimmer agreed to do the music for the film because wow. he said when he watched it, it had changed him as a person. He looked at things in a different way. And he talked about creating a soundscape that would be like a frozen lake and Lenore walking on it and never knowing where the cracks were. Hmm. And the cracks are the trauma, like going back to Italy, that come up when you least expect it. So I thought he had an incredible image. Working with him was one of the most creative experiences I've had working on films.
That sounds thrilling.
Really is. That's given me goosebumps.
Yeah.
I mean, that is exactly it. That, you know, she's frozen in time, you know, in a sense, but never knowing when those things will be triggered or where the dangers lie again of her psychological sense of self.
Which is true for every survivor. Running
really
into that
is.
Person again, even if they're behind bars, they may get out one day.
And the post-traumatic stress that stays with many, and it freezes them to live their lives in a free way. The potential of their human self, their self-esteem, every part of them has been impacted, but she turns it into something very different. And I think that's the incredible thing that you have done here, giving Lenore a platform and a voice. And I mean, this was over, we'll go back to what happened that night, but you did follow her story, was it for 5 years, to put it in context? So 10 years later, she wants to find her voice and she wants to find, you know, justice and go on that journey. But you followed with this journey with her through the lens for 5 years. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we started filming in 2008 at the 10th anniversary of the Miss World competition, and it was finished in the end of 13. So,
wow.
Yes, it was a 5-year journey.
So I'd love to talk about your journey as well, because it's one that you have been on as a shiro. I say shiro because these are female heroes for sure and survivors. But through the lens, you're going on this incredible journey too. But before we go into that, take us back to that night.
So she did convince him to drop her off at the train station in Milan. It turns out they had never left Milan. They had been driving around in circles. There was no flight from Rome. He had never booked a ticket for her. So she talked him down. She said, I know you're a good man. Now just take me to the train station. He dropped her off there. He watched her get on the train. She tried not to let him see, you know, how she was feeling. She was afraid that he would kill her if she showed any weakness. She got on the train. It was about to leave. She left her bags on the train and called her mom from a payphone at the station. And she said, Mom, you know, he tricked me, tried to kill me, he raped me. And her mom at that moment said, Lenore, don't worry. You're going to be all right. We're going to help you. Just go to the police, go to the hospital, and don't take a shower, and you're going to be okay. So she said that's really what saved her life.
Wow.
She boarded that train, which at the time was a longer train, and she didn't have a cell phone. There were many stops. Her mom didn't know, you know, what would happen to her, but her mother called Lenore's boyfriend in Israel at the time, and he had a friend in Rome who he had been in school with, and he asked that friend, Ophira, to be at the train station in Rome to meet her. Ophira had never met Lenore, but she'd seen her picture. She was Miss Israel, so she knew who she was waiting for. And when she got off the train, Lenore found someone there to support her. And, you know, the two of them went to the police. They went to the hospital. Ophira later testified at her trial in Israel. And they didn't see each other for 10 years until we went back to Italy with Lenore.
Yeah.
And they met again on the same train tracks. And that's one of my favorite scenes in the film. But so Lenore was able to report the crime. The Italian police immediately arrested the rapist. They had him in custody. They had the DNA evidence. They had the plastic bag. They had the rope. The knife was never found, but they had plenty of evidence. However, the judge decided that there wasn't enough evidence, and they released him.
The Italian system, again, which we've covered a number of times.
And
we've seen a couple of glaring examples of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a definite shame, and it's more than that. It's a blatant miscarriage of justice.
Well, there was a prosecutor who cared about the case and who you know, who believed that Lenore was raped, but she wasn't able to do anything. But later on, when Lenore managed to get the jurisdiction transferred to Israel, that prosecutor also traveled to Israel and testified on her behalf. So it wasn't the whole Italian, you know, judicial system, but the judge definitely, I mean, he later stepped down. I don't know if it was as a result of that case. But I've seen that here, too. I mean, what about the judge in the Brock Turner case?
Right. And yeah.
So judges need an education.
Absolutely. And in my experience, I don't know about you, Laura, but it's so difficult to get into the College of Judges and train them. They don't want to hear from anybody. They just think we know everything and we're going to be neutral, and so we don't need training from anybody.
Absolutely. We've been trying to get into judges and magistrates in the UK, and it's just the hardest thing to get into their training.
Unbelievable. I had more success in Central America and Southeast Asia talking to the judges. Mm-hmm. I mean, judges actually coming to the conference and meeting with prosecutors and investigators and being trained by us, because we actually have a level of expertise that they wanted to know about. But our judges in our own country wouldn't listen to us.
And I think they should be ticketed so that on specialist areas like sexual violence, domestic violence, stalking, child abuse, that they should be ticketed. They should have to go to certain sessions to be able to preside over certain cases because of all this nuanced detail. But I have to say, I mean, I am shocked in some senses, because when you understand the evidence in this case, you know, I'm just having the visual image of her underwear and the blood and just everything. You know, they seized a lot of that evidence.
What did they need?
I mean, it's clearly not compliant.
Think that there would be
consensual. I mean, this is just incredible in many senses, but not surprising when you understand the context. So
I'm sure she was bruised, and I'm sure that she had other physical evidence, and the fact that she told about what happened and said that he had a knife and threatened her.
She had stab marks.
It's absolutely enough evidence to prosecute. There's no question about it, unless you're biased against the victims of rape, I guess.
The doctor who examined her also later flew to Israel to testify, but we went back to film him. That scene isn't in the film, but it's on the DVD extras, and he talked about being afraid, still 10 years later, of that rapist. The rapist threatened him then.
Oh, really?
Yes.
The rapist who's in jail.
In the courtroom, he made a threatening comment to the doctor, and that stayed with him that long, that he was still afraid to come on camera and testify that Lenore had been, you know, stabbed and raped, to be the one to present the evidence. And
so in an open court, he makes a threat.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is
why
just...
Why wouldn't that be prosecuted as well?
Exactly. But it also tells you about his arrogance and his confidence and his audacity, which you do see some of that when he's on camera, where he's barefaced, I did not do this. And you can see that he's switched the narrative. But we'll talk about that and perpetrators, and in particular those who get away with it over and over again.
How they get emboldened.
Absolutely.
Well, yes, and the trial was very traumatic for Lenore, and the rapist lawyer said to her, you clearly wanted it, you're a tall girl, you couldn't have been raped in the back seat of this small car unless you complied, you know, and kept attacking her and telling her that it was clearly consensual. And she, her lawyer told me, finally stood up and said to him, I hope that one day, if you have a daughter, she doesn't have to go through anything like what you're putting me through right now.
That's great.
And apparently that was a turning point in the case.
Wow, what an incredible thing to say. Because, I mean, actually, when I talk to prosecutors and law enforcement, I always say, if this was your daughter, your sister, your mother, what are you thinking now? Because until you humanize it, until you make people stand in the shoes that it's someone that they care about, you know, these examinations, cross-examinations in court, some of them are, and, you know, Jim's been a prosecutor, but some of them are just absolutely outrageous. I mean, we still have the situation in the UK where someone's sexual history can be used against them. And we've just had a high-profile case, someone called Cheddar Evans, who the conviction was overturned in court purely because, and he'd already served a sentence, because Section 41 of our Youth and Criminal Justice Act allows someone's sexual history to be put before the court. She was totally discredited, and this is something we're trying to change.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, you won't believe this, Cecilia, he's just written a piece for The Times, having come out of prison, about how women can avoid being raped by real rapists. his psychology is just incredible. So there's a response to that that one of our feminists, our leading feminist, Jean Hatchett, has written in the Huffington Post about really challenges. Well, what is a real rapist? And, you know, it's advice to Chet Evans. She's kind of turned it on its head because 90% of rapes are by someone that's known.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when we understand, just in the UK context, and I know, you know, there were three countries involved here, but our conviction rate, and in terms of cases that are prosecuted and convicted, we only have a 7% conviction rate for rape because of all these attitudes that we still need to challenge about what is a real rape. You know, and those cases, the 7%, are really the stranger type cases that are really difficult to get to court too. So if you're raped by someone that's known, does that mean that's not a real rape? Is it when someone drinks, it's not a real rape? Well, our consent laws is actually about, or I should say, our sexual violence laws are about gaining consent. The onus is on the perpetrator to gain that consent. And of course, at knife point under duress, if someone's drunk and they're not conscious, they cannot consent.
Well, as Lenore says, rape can be done through manipulation, coercion, threats. You don't need a weapon. It can even be done with a smile, as she says. And Lenore gets very offended when people ask her about how you can prevent a rape. She says that's the wrong conversation. The conversation should be on educating boys, and in some cases, maybe women, but on how to be respectful of other people's bodies.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, we've just done a podcast with Professor Evan Stark around coercion and talking about sexual coercion in particular, something that's not talked about so much. But of course, there are those that think, well, there has to be a weapon. There has to be physical evidence. You know, there has to be physical trauma, bruising for it to be a rape. So the raising awareness and challenging attitudes and stereotypes is everything that Real Crime Profile is trying to also get out there. In terms of what the true messages are.
Yeah, because it's critically important to understand that once consent is taken away, that's it. Everything after that is the crime. And just because somebody becomes compliant because they don't want to die does not mean they're actually acquiescing to being sexually assaulted or raped. And that is something that everybody in law enforcement should know on every side, and it shouldn't be something that defense attorneys can... I mean, it's just unbelievable what some of those defense attorneys will do to try to get their clients off.
But not only don't want to die, a lot of the survivors talk about believing that there is nothing they can do. They're afraid of being overpowered physically. They feel that they got themselves in the situation and they leave their bodies. They talk about feeling like a corpse. Mm. They're frozen. They can't react. Even if there's no weapon, there's so many cases where they just feel that consent has been taken away. There's nothing they can do, so let's just get this over with.
Right. Yeah, I was talking about an extreme case, but yes, mm-hmm. absolutely. Consent can be taken away in multiple different forms.
Something he did that came up in the documentary, when he takes her to the train station and he says, you know, call me when you get there so that I know you're okay. I mean, what a crazy... How did you react to that when he says that? Like, does he not understand...
He bought into his own rationalization.
What he's done.
And her survival tactic, which was pretend that she liked him. So she had to put him in that frame of mind so that she could get away and survive. And so, yes, that's what he wanted to believe.
This is a man who had a bag over her head and was suffocating her to death.
Mm-hmm.
And this is him switching the narrative. And this tells us everything about his psychology, that she has survived it. And what a clever and smart thing to do, her intuitive self reacting. And you can never teach someone those things, incidentally. I mean, Jim and I are asked a lot, well, what should you do? And actually, a lot of it comes down to your intuitive self of, you know, the fight or flight mechanism, things that are not at a conscious level. But he wants to buy into this because now he can switch the narrative out that this is what it's about. It's a consensual thing, and he can absolve himself of any responsibility. And he is absolutely reprehensible.
I saw that it really healed me, and it still heals me now when I speak out to all millions of women around the world. I believe that when you speak out, it makes you realize that this bad thing that happened to you doesn't make you who you are, and doesn't define you, and that you can move on.
So she flew back to Israel later that night after she had reported the crime in Rome. Then she went to compete as in Miss World, won the crown. In the interim, she had reported in Israel, but Israel put a block on any news stories around it because they had already decided that they would get jurisdiction of the case and try to apprehend him there. He had family in Israel. His wife and children were in Israel.
Wow.
So they had established that he did return to Israel. And I believe, and maybe you guys can help with this, that the law that enabled her to get the jurisdiction changed was something that had been on the books since the end of the Second World War, when if crimes are committed against an Israeli citizen outside of Israel, they have the right to have it tried in their own country.
Concurrent jurisdiction, yes. Yeah. And that would be because it's a protective mechanism, because they didn't think that other countries would honor the rights of Israeli citizens.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So he was apprehended at the airport, at Ben-Gurion Airport, the next time he came back, and he was put in custody. And by that time, she had a fierce prosecutor on her side who had discovered that he had been charged with these crimes before. This was also during her reign as Miss World, so it was very hard for her to fulfill her duties. She was too traumatized to travel. I mean, to this day, Lenore sleeps with the lights on. She really can't be alone. She cannot go in an elevator alone. These things are just terribly frightening for her. So she wasn't the best Miss World. In fact, I think she was excused from most of her duties.
Or was she one of the best, because she made so many changes, real life changes for victims? I mean, really across the world.
Well, that was her goal, was to give her crown true meaning, and also why we called the film Brave Miss World. Then she underwent the trial, which, as we talked about, was so hard on her. It resulted in his conviction.
How long did it take for him to come back to Israel for them to get him?
That was in the next few months. I think he returned in maybe March of 1999. Okay. So maybe two or three or four months after the rape and after she was crowned Miss World. He was given the longest sentence for rape to date in Israel for the crime,
wow.
which
was 16 years, which she considers not nearly long enough, and felt that he should have been tried for attempted murder as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. And she does talk about the secondary victimization at the hands of the system, doesn't she, in the documentary, which again just compounds someone's post-traumatic stress when they're asked to relive this and they're questioned in the way that we've just talked about.
Yes, and that's one of the reasons she wanted to make the film, which was very hard on her. She had no idea how triggering and traumatic it would be to talk to other survivors, bring her own story back up, but she wanted other people to know that if she could survive it, they could, that if it could happen to her, it can happen to anyone. I mean, it happened to the most beautiful girl in the world. So she really sacrificed a lot of her own stability in order to be of help to others.
And that journey was, you know, incredible, of her talking to so many survivors all around the world. I mean, it took her across the world, all of you. I mean, she went to South Africa as well, didn't she?
She did, and that she visited a place called the Teddy Bear Clinic in Soweto. I might start crying if I talk about this. But it's a place for childhood victims of rape. She met with a room full of girls who were, 12 years old, who'd been raped as children. And the fact that she came there into the sweltering tiny little room in a clinic in Soweto was really the difference for them between believing that they could go on or not. I mean,
absolutely.
And I saw her put her arms around them. She gathers them all up. You have to see it in the film. And I just watched her right then become someone who she understood could be a tremendous advocate and make a huge difference.
Yes, that's such a powerful part of the film. And those girls that you capture are just...
It's heartbreaking.
Unbelievable. And then you go on to interview many more lesser known and very well known people who have a celebrity following and tell their story. You go to talk to Joan Collins and Fran Drescher, who has told her story many, many times, mm-hmm. but even it sounded very fresh when she told her story to you. And I've heard her tell that story about her own rape and her own trauma with
her
husband.
Well, yeah, I was so grateful to both of them for stepping up. And Joan had written about her story but had never talked about it on camera before. And she is someone who was raped at 17 and felt so guilty that she married him. Or she thought, I've lost my virginity to him, I have to marry him, and was in a very abusive marriage. But I think the fact that she talked about that on camera, I'm sure, has given so much courage to other women who are in abusive
Absolutely.
Marriages.
Really,
absolutely,
really is, yeah, incredible that she did speak out to you. And I mean, if we back up to South Africa, I just want to sort of make the point that women there are much more likely to be raped than educated. And having worked out there, we talked about it with the Reeva Steenkamp case, just the context of violence against women and girls there. And I'm sure Lenore, you could see it on camera, just how they welcomed her. But only one in 56 rapes are actually reported there. And I'm sure many of the people that you spoke with and Lenore spoke with had never spoken out or reported it to the police. That their violence is just off the scale in terms of how women and girls are treated. And three women are murdered a day by their partner or ex-partner there.
Well, there's no access, no path to justice for them there. But it's also true here. And really, I think what you're doing to create these conversations is so important. But Lenore also, she got strength from the South African women, because although they often weren't able to report or see justice done, they weren't ashamed. They told their stories, you know, without shame. And I think that's something that helped her continue on too and try to understand what they had, you know, their self-esteem and self-worth that was strong in spite of what happened to them.
Yeah. It was a beautiful scene. As terribly tragic as it was so great that Lenore had made a connection with them. And that scene where she's hugging them is very beautiful.
So as I'm watching your film and I'm watching all of these different people tell their stories, you know, all of a sudden a face comes on the screen, a face that I know and who I love dearly, and he tells his story about his own sexual abuse. And it was Jim. And I could not believe my eyes or my ears.
Yeah, well, I remember, Cecilia, when you first started telling me about the project, and I, of course, was taken in by the topic and about your stories about Lenore and how brave she was and how amazing the fact is that she was able to, one, survive, two, keep it together enough to actually compete and win the Miss World competition, and then three, decide when she was finally ready and able to tell the world. And that's a big step, and I know from personal experience how difficult that can be. And for me, too, it was 10 years. But it was 10 years before I reported it to the police and the FBI. So she was a lot braver than I was. And I remember talking to you about it and saying, what about the male voice? Because there are definitely male victims of rape and sexual assault and molestation and abuse. And also, most males, are absolutely horrified and offended by the concept of rape, and they could never do it themselves. And it was so great when you said to me, well, would you be willing to go on camera? And I said, absolutely, and especially because Lenore is such a shining example. And I never heard the term Shiro before, but I would definitely put her in that category along with you for telling her story. But just, I remember very clearly the day that I met Lenore, and she has such a presence. It's amazing. There are few people in the world that have that power, that aura around them that gives you the confidence to be able to, you know, trust them immediately and tell them everything. So I remember that very well. Can you tell us about your side of that equation?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, one thing I remember sort of the same way but slightly differently is that when we were seeking funding for the film, and the way the film got financed was a whole nother very hard mountain to climb that maybe I can tell you about, but some people were saying, well, are you going to show the other side, you know, the men's side or the rapist side? And I remember you saying, Jim, there's only one other side, and that's the side of men who have also been victims of assault and rape. There is no rapist side.
Right. Not to this story.
So I don't know if you know this, but when we screened the film for some of our potential financiers, one of the people who stepped up to become one of the great supporters of our film and gave us the money to finish the film was a wonderful producer named Regina Kulik Scully from San Francisco, whose brother was a victim of sexual assault. And he was on the Oprah show with you when went on. And when she saw the footage of that, of you and her brother in the audience, that's when she decided to fund our film. Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes.
I just got chills when you said that. That's amazing.
Yeah. So without knowing it, you were responsible for us being able to finish the film.
Wow.
Well done, Jim C.
Well, I do remember when Lenora was talking to me and we were having a conversation. It was just as revealing and educational to me as it was to her when she was asking me about my story. And I got the feeling that she was still not aware of the fact that the week that the guy had talked to her on the phone, and the fact that he was saying how he was trying to help her, and the fact that he was promoted by her modeling agency, and the fact that when he offered to drive her, he was doing her a favor. All those things are grooming. And the fact that he took her to his house, as Laura mentioned earlier, he was trying to check whether she was going to be compliant to that level. And he'd take it one step further and one step further and one step further. And that whole process is exactly how sex offenders groom victims into situations where they can take advantage of their vulnerability. And I think that in that conversation, she came to that realization.
She did, and you articulate it in the film, and we all are familiar with these cases, so we know how victims are groomed, but I think most people don't know. Lenore wasn't even aware that she'd been groomed, so right. It's a very important scene in the film, I think, for the audience and for Lenore.
Yeah,
I mean, when you're victimized, how can you be an expert on and everything to do with it? And that's what I find when I talk with victims, you know, and survivors. And there's a difference between those two terms. I mean, I do say when someone's being victimized or they're trying to survive domestic violence or stalking, they haven't survived it yet if it's ongoing. But a survivor is somebody who can take something that was out of their control and focus on the things they can control and change things, which Lenore has. And she's become not just a hero, but a real role model for people. And I think, you know, many families and victims will say to me, you know, if only I'd met you before. Because then, you know, experts, Jim and I, we can explain things. But why should you be an expert in everything that happens to you? And how can you possibly understand the criminal justice system and how it works and how it operates? Many professionals who even work in it don't really understand, you know, the criminal justice system and how it operates. And Lenore here had to understand it in a number of different countries as well, and her fight for justice. And I just think it's so incredible that she turned around, you know, such a situation, but then she goes on the look, she goes searching for other women who'd experienced, you know, trauma and violence and abuse at his hands.
Right. And she also went to law school and graduated with honors and went to work in the Tel Aviv District Attorney's Office. Yeah. But she did feel that she wanted to find the other survivors of the same rapist to help her appeal to the parole board to keep him behind bars. And that was another traumatic process for her. Every 6 months, he had a parole hearing. And in Israel, the victim is not allowed to appear at the parole hearing. I believe we are here. Is that right,
yes.
Jim?
And in the UK, actually.
You can at least send a written statement and a summary of the facts. Here, it's not always. It's up to the parole board, really, whether they want to bring witnesses or not.
How long has that been for? Because ours has only just changed in England and Wales that you can do that. You can have a victim advocate or the victim, you know, or a statement. Has that been?
Yeah, but it's been around for a long time here. But it radically differs from parole board to parole board, and you know, certain states are much more lenient towards defendants, like California. It's in the Ninth Circuit, which is a federal district that is the most liberal and most pro-defendant. But there are other much more conservative jurisdictions across the country that give the victim a much greater voice in any kind of parole hearing. So we'd like to talk a little more about Lenore today and how she has transformed her life.
So, Cecilia, I wanted to ask you just to tell us about her journey where she's looking for other victims at his hands because she knows that he has abused others. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes, and let me say that, you know, all these decisions were hard on her because her attitude, she would have liked to just not think about any of it. Even though she wanted to make a film, she didn't know what, you know, she had to step away for 6 months at one point. It was just too hard on her. And with his parole hearings and the idea of him going on furloughs, she said, I don't care, I don't want to think about it. But I could see that it was terribly traumatic for her. So she did feel that she needed to find these victims, so his other victims. So when we were in Italy, we had been searching for the girl who worked for him, who had pressed charges against him. That survivor had called Lenore when Lenore's case came out in the news and said, I just want you to know he did the same thing to me. And
wow.
I wish you luck, Lenore. Please, you know, fight hard. Put him behind bars. But that was the last time she'd heard. So when we were back in Milan, she wanted to find her. And we had a private detective searching for her. She had just gone underground. And it was the last day of our filming there. And Lenore was having an ice cream and a kosher deli, and a girl came up to Lenore and she said, are you Lenore? And Lenore had a feeling she knew who it was, and she said, I'm the girl that Noor raped here. He did the same thing to me 16 years ago. And Lenore said, oh my God, I've been looking for you everywhere. You know, she said, can we film you? And the girl said, no, I have a family. Please don't expose me. I can't tell anyone about this. But Moti, Lenore's friend, had captured a little bit of it on his iPhone. We blurred her image out of respect, but Lenore felt that it was a sign to her from the universe that she was on the right track. And out of 3 million people in Milan,
mm-hmm. What are the chances of that on the last
chances?
Day?
And, you know, we didn't even talk about how Lenore turned, to religion to give her strength during this. It's a big part of her story. One time I thought that it was too far from the through line and the narrative of the film, but then I began to see that every survivor has to turn to something.
They cope in different ways and at different times.
Yeah.
It's normal.
It's a roller coaster ride, and you know, people think there's closure at the end of a court case, but there is absolutely not. The journey is a life course journey, and you take strength where you can from different things.
Right, and that was her source of strength, and, you know, the film doesn't, I think, judge it. It just presents it, and in fact, I think her very unusual way of coping actually makes it so universal because it shows that it doesn't just go away. You need something, and as her mom says, a lot of victims become anorexic or alcoholic or bulimic, but Lenore's religious now. That's her choice. That's fine. You know, she became Orthodox. She went from being the most beautiful swimsuit model, very proud of her body, to somebody who's very much, you know, covered up and modest. But for her, she feels it gives her a control and a structure to her life that's very important to her.
And they are two extremes, aren't they, of a continuum? And I remember, you know, at the start of the documentary where she's addressing rooms full of people where people are talking about the pageants, you know, and is it the right thing to have, you know, women on display, etc. And her saying, well, it's a choice. It should be, you know, somebody's choice as to what they do and how they present themselves. And then, of course, she's at this other end of the extreme where everything is covered. And it certainly is a big journey for her across, you know, and still ongoing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. But she now is a global activist on behalf of survivors. She's spoken at The Hague. She speaks almost every day publicly. She's booked as much as she's willing and able to speak, and she's become a huge force in the fight against sexual violence.
which is incredible, giving lots of other people a voice. And I wanted to just say something about, you know, having worked on lots of serial cases where, you know, serial rape cases, there is something about bringing the voices of victims, those who have survived, into a room and them sharing their experiences. And there's some interesting thing that I found, certainly through working serial rape cases, is that when a person understands they are one of a number of people who've been victimized, it actually does free them in a sense psychologically, because they understand it's not just a personal thing to them where they're blaming and shaming themselves. And actually they're the cases where where women are most likely to give a statement to the police when they know they are one of a number. And that certainly played out in this case as well. And we have to remember that many perpetrators are serial. You know, if they're behaving in this way and getting away with it, they will keep doing it time and time again. And this is something I feel really strongly about, having been, you know, a profiler and analyst in this area for 20 years. I really do not think that professionals understand the scale of serial rapists. And, you know, if you put Pareto's principle to it, 80% committed by the 20%. Mm-hmm. And these are people who should be on a register. And this is exactly why Paladin are campaigning for a register for serial stalkers and domestic violence offenders, those who are predatory, and making sure that they are on a register that law enforcement can tap into. And when they travel to other countries, that they may well be offending there, because he also had a history, was it in France as well? Allegations were made, yes, in France too about him.
Yes. And, well, I just also, you know, I'm most proud of creating BraveMissWorld.com with Lenore, where we are one of the largest websites globally serving rape survivors and their families, and every single testimonial that's submitted is curated and receives a supportive response, and it's a forum for so many survivors to seek resources and get support from a community who respects and understands them, and I think for many of them maybe the only place or the first time that they have been able to share their stories.
Well, that's a resource that we'd like to get out there to our listeners, and BraveMissWorld.com, and this, if you need this resource or you want to learn more about this topic and maybe be able to help, as well as be able to refer friends or loved ones who might have issues related to this. This is a great resource, and we really thank you, Cecilia, for your time and the work that you did on Brave Miss World. There's so much more we can talk about. Hopefully we can talk to you more about it in the future.
Everybody can go out and watch the film. It's on Netflix.
It's on Netflix.
And please, all of our listeners should go out and click on it right now. It's an amazing, amazing
film.
It's 88 minutes long, and you will be absolutely gripped. And there's the hashtag I Am Brave as well, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
Of people sharing their stories. So our listeners can have a look at Brave Miss World on our Twitter site. We'll be putting things out. And I also think with him, just the other point is that he was married, and being married can sometimes be something that somebody hides behind as a smokescreen.
Mm-hmm.
But normally you would see control issues and abuse in that marriage. That's certainly something that I've seen. So I think, you know, that's another sort of breaking the stereotypes and myths about who and what rapists are. And I think you cover that really well in the documentary. But I did just have one question for you, Cecilia, of what was the most moving part, you know, for you following Lenore in this incredible journey of 5 years? Were there any sort of real standout moments for you?
I mean, as mentioned, that moment in the Teddy Bear Clinic in Soweto, but I think overall just watching her be strong enough to overcome all the trauma that it was bringing up, because she believed that it was more important to be of service to other survivors than to take care of herself. I think, you know, that was my huge inspiration and what guided me through all of the setbacks and difficulties in raising the money and persuading people to look at Rough Cuts or program us in a festival, just thinking of what Lenore went through to tell her story.
Absolutely. And how can we help you? Because I know you do global screenings as well, and I would love to do one in London, and I'd love to talk to you more about that. But so you can do screenings across the globe, or how can we help you get the messages out there?
We have an educational screening series, and anyone who wants to show the film in a high school or college or a community screening can just go to the website, bravemissworld.com, and click on Screen the Film. We're just finishing a 45-minute high school curricular version. So if you have any teachers or educators who listen, would like to bring the film, we now have a classroom-length version that can be shown in a double period and followed by a discussion. We have a high school discussion guide. So we're working hard on bringing the film to communities, men, women, boys, and girls who need it most. And the film, you know, creates a safe space to talk about these issues.
That's great.
It really does.
Critically necessary in this world, absolutely, because talking about it actually takes some of the power away from the offenders. And speaking out and getting your story out there and letting people know they're not alone, man, I wish I had that when I was a kid.
Thank you for having this conversation and sharing it with your listeners. Lenore's whole goal is to make sure that survivors don't suffer in silence.
We thank you. You know, this has just been such a fantastic opportunity to talk to you and raise awareness. And thank you so much for your incredible work. And I know you've been nominated for an Emmy, but also various other received various other honors for your work. And you really are so well deserving, you and Lenore. So thank you.
Well, thanks. And I feel like it's such a serious conversation. But Lenore, one of her coping mechanisms is her sense of humor. And I just want to mention, you know, that is another way to get through it. And Jim, I think you share that. And
yeah.
It's so important.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, look, every single person is going to deal with it differently. But I think the more we talk about it, the more we normalize this conversation in our families, in our communities, in our schools, in all youth-serving organizations, the more we empower people to not become victims, and we empower victims to come forward and get help and actually go on and live wonderful lives. Well, thank you, everybody, and thank you so much for listening to Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.